Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 23rd of April. The question of this hour is a large one. Is the world as we know it heading for collapse? Our guest this hour wrote an interesting piece that caught our attention in The Guardian. NASA-funded study, industrial civilization headed for irreversible collapse. Natural and social scientists develop a new model of how a perfect storm of crises could unravel the global system. And the study attempts also to make sense of compelling historical data showing that the process of rise and collapse is actually a recurrent cycle that is found throughout history. Nafez Mossadegh Ahmed is our guest this hour. He is an interesting person. He's an international security analyst. Nafez is executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development based in England. He started that when he was 22 years old. He's author of A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It, among many other books. He is a British Bangladeshi of Muslim faith who has written extensively on Islamic terrorism and his relationships with other major crises. He has a doctorate from the University of Sussex and 5 books, and we have a lot to talk about this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we look at this perfect storm of events that could do us in, but he remains pretty optimistic, and we'll find out why. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Nafez, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Kathleen.
Let's talk first about the NASA study, which you wrote an article about that's in The Guardian. This one seems to be by a fairly reputable group of people and kind of looks at what we're facing now, but also puts this in a historical perspective. Do the historical perspective for us, would you please?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the study wasn't actually a NASA study. It was a project at a university in the United States, where they specialize in studying the intersection of different crises, environmental, economic, energy, and all that. And the lead author of the study, Dr. Safa Mutashari, not doctor. I mean, he is a PhD graduate, but his colleagues who co-authored the study were well-known scientists and academics at other established institutions. And basically, they received funding from NASA to create an Earth system model. Now, that funding was used also to create this particular model that was run for the study that was eventually published in the Journal of Ecological Economics. The model is known as the Handy model. Now, what they did is they calibrated the model on the basis of looking at historical cases of civilizations rising and falling. What they tried to do is understand, you know, what's happened in the past. That seems to be that gives us a kind of a good idea of what we can model now. And then that gives us an idea of how we can kind of test, you know, what are the major challenges or stresses that we could face in contemporary kind of modern civilization. So, you know, it's quite interesting to look at the way they review the historical cases, because they go through quite a lot of different examples, from well-known things like the Roman Empire to, you know, maybe, you know, not so well-known cases such as, you know, the collapse of the Mayan civilization and other even more obscure civilizations. And what they argue is that when you look at actually, you know, the way in which these civilizations have kind of risen and fallen over time, it actually seems to be a very clear recurring issue, not something which, you know, is some kind of strange, you know, kind of unique event that can happen. A civilization might face problems or collapse or crumble. That, and this is a very unique thing. Actually, this is something that happens a lot, and in fact, has happened throughout human history. So I think that obviously, to some extent, I found quite fascinating, going against the grain of the, I guess we have a conventional sense that, you know, civilizations are generally enduring kind of, you know, there's enduring systems of life which span many, many hundreds of years. And I guess the origins of those civilizations and the end of those civilizations is something that we don't perhaps think about, you know, that much. Rather, we focus, you know, historically, we tend to focus on, you know, how these civilizations were, you know, how they functioned, what their traditions were, their beliefs, you know, how they fought against each other and that kind of thing. So that was an interesting take for me. And I think, you know, it gives the model a very interesting grounding to kind of see that, well,
yes,
actually, it's not, this isn't a strange aberration or something. It's something that's happened very often. In fact, it is a historical, almost a historical law in a way that... So, obviously, has important implications, I think, that are worth thinking about today.
And one of the things that has happened historically and that we have spent a lot of time on this program talking about is that this huge gap between those who have a whole lot and those who have almost nothing. You write about the economic stratification of society, elites, the rich and the masses, the commoners, and those social phenomena playing a central role in the collapse, in all such cases, over the last 5,000 years. What does that have to do with the collapse of a civilization?
Well, it's quite interesting because, I mean, this is definitely a new thing that, you know, other people who have studied the collapses of past civilizations haven't quite focused on this issue. For example, a well-known anthropologist, Joseph Tainter, who is actually an expert in the collapse of civilizations, hasn't looked at this particular issue of economic stratification. Whereas these guys who've reviewed his work and also looked at a lot of other body of work have argued that actually this kind of under-researched issue was actually played a very central role in most cases of civilizational collapse in the past. And the reason that is, they say, is that there were kind of the deep economic stratification of society tended to have a number of kind of consequences for that society which were destabilizing. Now, one of those, they argue, and it obviously happened in different ways in different contexts, but one of those, generally, they argue, is that when you have too much economic stratification, one of the instabilities that can generate is when the elites end up over-consuming. Because they're amassing all of the resources or wealth for themselves, they get into this kind of dangerous dynamic where they're over-consuming and kind of breaching the limits of the environment around them, whatever natural limits there might be, for example, maybe in agriculture or other kind of issues. And that can eventually then create a problem when the masses or the commoners, as they describe them in the model, are left increasingly out of that equation, and this creates a state of instability which can lead to internal conflict, internal rebellions, and ultimately they argue is that that kind of situation can eventually lead the whole structure of that civilization to become unstable and eventually to collapse or to crumble, and you know, that could happen over a longer period of time, or it could happen quickly, depending on, you know, what the specifics of the situation. And there are also other issues, I think, you know, which they highlight in relation to economic stratification, which are simply to do with the relationship between, you know, these two kind of classes, and the way that class kind of conflict can play out in terms of destabilizing. So, I mean, there's the one thing is really the kind of the resource issue and the overconsumption of resources, which can create environmental problems for the civilization. And the other is, you know, that this internal, perhaps political, or conflict that might arise between people who are left out of that, you know, kind of accumulating process. And of course, I think what they're also interested in is how those two kind of factors can actually collide. And that would, in a way, create the kind of, I think in those cases, you know, you might have an accelerated collapse where you have a combination of environmental challenges because of the way in which resources are being overconsumed and the combination of internal, how that kind of plays off with internal instability when, you know, people are angry, they're upset, they're going to basically start challenging the existing system, asking questions about it, maybe even you have the danger of violence. So I think those two things are the main things that they look at.
You also, I think you make reference to this, that the elites may have a tendency to not see the whole, that there's a kind of absorption in having five houses and billions of dollars and being involved in the game to have more and more, but not having really much of a secondary awareness as to how many people are in utter poverty in the world, actually, how many people are really struggling. You're walking your own path.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think they, the authors of the study, on the one hand, they draw some very interesting conclusions about the way in which elites appear to have been unable to anticipate the consequences of their own actions.
Mm-hmm.
And how those consequences are actually ultimately self-defeating in the long run. And I think it's partly, you know, I mean, they speculate to some extent. And obviously, you know, one can't generalize too much about these very specific historical cases. But, you know, I think they generally kind of conclude that you know, this for some reason, it's something about that position of being in that position and over-accumulating that prevents them from really seeing that actually this is not going to work. And I guess the modern parallel which they warn about when they run the model in relation to a scenario that would fit the world today. And that's where it gets interesting, because they basically find that we have a very similar kind of situation where if you kind of model the same kinds of resources available today globally, the same kinds of very, very large economic inequalities globally, as well as the kind of the scale of the environmental challenges that we face. And they conclude that it looks like, I mean, they model a number of different possible scenarios, but in all of them, it does seem that largely the elites tend not to really grasp the scale of what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, to some extent, you know, the study itself doesn't really, you know, explore why that is. You know, and I guess it's not really the place of that particular study to do so. It's simply looking at historical data, some empirical data, and it's creating a, you know, quantitative model for today and just running it and seeing what happens. And they do try to discuss it, but I think, you know, you do need to do a little bit more analysis, but I think it doesn't really take a genius, you know, to kind of see that already, you know, the last 10 years, if we look at what's been happening with climate change, what's been happening with the way in which, you know, after the banking collapse, you know, there is certainly this very clear and obvious trajectory of let's continue business as usual because that's what works
right.
for us.
Right. That's, you know, what we know. You, when you have written also about the crisis of civilization, you have said that the crisis fundamentally is linked to our dependence on fossil fuels. Talk more about that.
Well, one of the things that isn't very much recognized within kind of orthodox economic theory is that the economic growth is tied to our ability to extract energy. Now, normal kind of economic theory doesn't acknowledge this at all. It just kind of assumes that we can continue on this trajectory of, you know, almost unlimited economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
But it simply ignores the very obvious empirical fact, which is very well documented, that actually, if you, you know, look at the trajectory of growth over the last few hundred years, and you plot it against a graph of energy consumption, you actually find that there's a very, very clear correlation between the way in which we've been able to grow our economies exponentially and the way in which we've also extracted energy exponentially. And that's not very surprising, because all our economic activity is dependent on energy. So it would be kind of obvious to kind of think that, well, actually, you know, if we're going to basically be kind of increasing our economic activity, then we're going to have to increase our extraction of energy. Now, this is where it gets kind of interesting, because obviously fossil fuels are a very specific kind of energy, in the sense that when we first discovered fossil fuels, and, you know, that this was linked to the Industrial Revolution, it was almost like we were opening this endless bonanza of power. And it did seem like this was going to last forever. And that's, there is something quite interesting about this new industrial era that we find ourselves in, which is that unlike previous ages of history, you know, we were kind of able to, really create this kind of system of unlimited economic growth simply because we had so much energy cheaply available.
Right.
Now, the problem we face is that this dependence on fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, is now leading us onto this kind of path of two intertwined dangers. The first issue is that energy is now becoming much more expensive. And I don't think we even need to bother getting into the whole debate about peak oil and whether we agree with the word peak or not. What is indisputable is that the prices of energy have gone up over the last decade or so, and they're going to continue to go up according to every kind of reasonable assessment, including the International Energy Agency. And that's because we are no longer relying so much on the cheap, easily available sources of oil that we traditionally have relied on to sustain economic activity. Instead, we're relying increasingly on more expensive shale gas and oil and tar sands and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And those forms of energy are much more difficult to extract, and they're much more expensive to extract. So that's, you know, and that kind of cuts across all of these kind of forms of energy, oil, gas, coal, even with coal, we're transitioning from the kind of cheap, easily available coal to much less kind of refined coal that is more difficult to extract and also doesn't really produce much enough energy as much energy as it was when we were kind of taking the best stuff right at the top. So that's the kind of obviously, you know, that's going to create a problem for us in terms of our ability to continue this, you know, the things that we're used to doing in terms of this kind of this way of life of kind of expecting everything very easy and cheaply on a plate and continuing this kind of form of growth that we're used to. That is now facing a kind of a break, and we're going to continue to see that unless we can find some way of dealing with that energy problem. The other problem, of course, is, you know, the elephant in the room of climate change, which is that our dependence on fossil fuels is releasing greenhouse gases, which are destabilizing the climate and which are contributing to a much more dangerous climate. And if we continue on that trajectory, again, you know, we're going to be facing a lot of very serious problems. And we've already kind of seen a taste of some of those potential challenges in the last few years with some of the extreme weather, the droughts, the food crises, and all of those kind of, you know, unpredictable kind of wild cards that are happening a lot more now. We're going to see a lot more of them. So I think those are the two real main challenges with fossil fuels.
And if we are indeed seeing the end of the age of fossil fuels, our guest is not totally pessimistic about this. He does believe that we have unprecedented opportunities to envision new forms of prosperity that will function in harmony with our environment rather than in conflict with it. What are those unprecedented opportunities? We'll talk about that as we continue. Dr. Nafees Ahmed is our guest this hour, joining us by phone from England. He's the executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development. He is the author of A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization. He writes for The Guardian on the geopolitics of environmental, energy, and economic crises on his Earth Insight blog, and he's a best-selling author as well. So what do you think? Are we beginning to see the end of the world as we know it? Do you remain optimistic? And we'll get into his optimism in a moment, that this is a chance for us to live quite differently. How would we do that? Will we do that? Are we on the verge of collapse? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our lines are quite filled. We will get to solutions and saving the planet as we continue our conversation with Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed. And let's start our calls with Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Thank you for taking the call. Your guest said that the elephant in the room is climate change. I think that is incorrect. It is human fertility. Thank you.
Population. You want to add that to the mix, Nafees?
Yeah, I mean, I think population is population growth. Obviously, is you know, is a real issue that needs to be dealt with. And I think anyone who thinks that, you know, we can kind of continue to kind of just keep growing human population to the projected, you know, 9 billion without creating serious problems is you know, clearly just not recognizing that, you know, I think the general message that we have here is that we need to kind of stop growing, you know, to such an out-of-control degree. And I think that applies to a whole host of issues. But I think it's important also to not, when it comes to dealing with population, it's important not to confuse the population growth issue as a fundamental cause of the crisis that we face, as opposed to a fundamental symptom, which then has a feedback effect on our society. Now, the reason I say this is because often, well, I mentioned that you can, if you plotted a graph of energy consumption and economic growth over the last, you know, couple of hundred years or so, and they'd correlate. But what some people have done is they've also taken a graph of population, world population, and they've correlated put it up against the same issues of energy consumption and economic growth, and you find they all go across this same kind of exponential line. So the argument then follows that, okay, we've had, clearly what we have here is that population growth is driving this kind of trajectory of unsustainable energy consumption, which is increasingly destroying the environment. Now, while I would say that there is the correlation is important, when you actually look a little bit deeper, the correlation breaks down. So when we start taking those graphs and applying them country by country, what we find is that the link between population and energy consumption breaks down. So in other words, if we look at countries like United States, United Kingdom, you know, countries in Western Europe, Russia, the major industrial countries, all of their populations are generally now rates of population growth are actually tapering off, and in some cases are likely to go into negative. However, if you look at how that correlates with energy consumption is rocketing. When you look at poorer countries of you know, what we call the global south, the less developed countries, or, you know, in other terms, people, you know, the third world or whatever you want to call them, those countries you find very, very, you know, rapid levels of population growth. And in many cases, those rates of growth are increasing. But at the same time, what you find is that their levels of energy consumption are much, much smaller, in fact, minimal, compared to the levels of energy consumption of the industrialized developed countries. So that's where you realize that actually when you look into the details of it, it's not just population. It's about energy consumption is about the nature of your energy system and your economic system and how it functions. Now, I think that doesn't mean that we should just say that's, you know, it's fine to kind of continue growing population willy-nilly and it's all going to be fine. That would also be a mistake. But I think assuming that population growth by itself is the driving cause of this rate, unsustainable rate of energy consumption, is, I would say, could be mistaken. What we need to do is look at what are the systems that are making this drive of unsustainable energy kind of consumption so out of control. And I think what we need to do now is kind of let's see what we can do to change that system and rein it in order that we can then also effectively taper off our population growth. So when you look at these poorer countries, what you find is that this kind of tendency to kind of have more children is linked to the poverty issues. So mm-hmm. people are having more children because those children are economic assets. They'll go out on the streets and they'll work. Whereas over here, you know, having kids can often be an economic liability. You know, you have two kids, three kids, and, you know, you've got to pay all your university fees and all the rest of it, and it's very expensive to have a family. So, you know, there is definitely an incentive, obvious incentive here to kind of taper it off. So that's why some people argue that in kind of more developed economies, you know, if you want to use that word, and I have a problem with that word being applied, you know, uncritically, but at the end of the day, if you have these, in our economies today, the fact is that there are much more successful in meeting certain needs that, you know, kind of healthcare needs, fundamental needs that in poorer countries, you know, basic things are not dealt with. So that, to me, I think, is if we perhaps look at a system which can deal with those basic needs in a much more equitable way, which isn't as environmentally destructive, then we may be able to solve this challenge.
Let's go next to Graydon in Milwaukee. Hi. Graydon, are you there? All right, let's go to Ruth in Eau Claire. Hi, Ruth.
Yes, hi. This is a wonderful conversation. I appreciate it very much. And maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but in terms of solutions, in Wisconsin, we have the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, which puts on the MREA, Midwest Renewable Energy Fair, mm-hmm. Which is in June, the weekend after Father's Day, in Custer, Wisconsin, not far from Stevens Point. And it's a amazing gathering, looking at all kinds of issues of sustainability. And it's over 3 days. It becomes a small city immediately because the numbers coming are so large. Just a wonderful thing for people to know about in Wisconsin. And then also I think in some ways talking about this issue, we would get further talking about pollution than climate change, because climate change becomes this political volleyball that, you know, just doesn't seem to get anywhere, versus looking at pollution, which then you look at facts and figures and, you know, what is happening to the water, what is happening to the soil, what is happening to the air, that just about everyone should care about.
Thank you, Ruth, for your call. Nuffies?
Yeah, I think that's thanks for raising this issue. It's really important to look at, you know, what are the kind of local programs of activity that are being, you know, spearheaded actually by, you know, by local businesses, local communities, local activists, local entrepreneurs. And they are really, in my view, and obviously we'll speak about this later, but I do really think that it's that kind of bottom-up power of the renewable energy revolution that is really going to be quite exciting. So, you know, certainly agree with the importance of having flagged that up, and hope your listeners can actually make sure that they attend that and do more of that kind of thing. Mm. On the issue of climate change and pollution, well, you know, I think it really does depend on who you're speaking to. And one has to kind of gauge, you know, where people are coming from, what are the things that concern them. And when we're talking about this kind of stuff, it's always important to it is important to speak a language that people understand. And in some cases, you know, the language of climate change, you know, to some extent, you know, with some audiences, has become quite muddied due to the success of fossil fuel-funded propaganda campaigns. But I think on the one hand, it's important to acknowledge that and to ensure that when you are speaking to people, to address the issues that are that they are concerned about, and say, well, hey, look, you know, actually, isn't this an issue? You know, isn't our water and our air an issue? Shouldn't we be thinking about that? But I do also think that ultimately, at some point, we are going to have to face this issue of how do we kind of raise awareness of the fact that this form of carbon pollution, if you want to call it that, is actually fundamentally altering and unbalancing the Earth's climate. And I think that's an important issue, and one that we do need to start grappling with, how we can begin to kind of push back against the propaganda and draw people's attention to well-known scientific facts. And for me, I think really it's about, having dealt with this kind of issue myself, you know, very directly, you know, I do think sometimes it's about restoring people's faith in science, you know, ironically, making people realize that actually there is a scientific consensus. It's the vast majority of the peer-reviewed scientific literature, literally 97% of the scientific peer-reviewed literature, which endorses this analysis that there is a real problem with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and its increase due to human activities. I think raising awareness of that is ultimately very important, but there's different ways of doing it. And I think maybe one very interesting way of doing it is to draw attention, actually, to the role of fossil fuel industries in kind of muddying this debate. Because I think your average person is very keenly aware of the role of dirty money, especially now with the banking crisis and the whole spectrum of continued economic problems. People are very, very concerned about that. They're concerned about corporations and the way that they're impinging on politics. So I think maybe raising awareness of, wait a minute, did you know that actually these agencies like ExxonMobil or the Koch brothers, for example, and other people are actually involved in financing this kind of questions about legitimate science, and in fact they're also funding politicians to get involved, and they're funding senators and they're influencing politics in a way which damages our democracy. And I think maybe that's a way to kind of get people to think, well, wait a minute, if that's the case, maybe they're trying to cover something up. Yeah.
And in terms of seeing things change, I think we've reached a point in this country and in many parts of the world where it's right outside your door. You know, we've got floods and we've got fires and big hurricanes and droughts going on and polar vortexes, which we never heard of before until this year. The signs are everywhere. It's not as though people aren't thinking about the climate changing. They're seeing it happen before their eyes.
Absolutely. I do think that if you look at them in the opinion polls over the last few years, I think most of them, I mean, there are a few which have shown that, there are majorities of people who are skeptical of the idea of climate change. But most of the polls consistently have actually shown that it's a slim majority of Americans and people across the world actually that do recognize that climate change is real and that it's largely linked to human activities and it's something we need to be dealing with. So I think there is I think most sensible people recognize that there is a problem and something needs to be done about it.
Mm-hmm. One of our emailers talked about the elephant in the room is not climate change, but actually it's human greed. So how do you change the whole mentality, the whole corporate mentality, the whole I'm going to make as much money as I can and have 10 houses and 15 boats and billions of dollars? How does that play into this? And do you need to change? And I don't know how you go about changing those heads of corporations who are getting all this money so that they can be more responsible to the earth, to human beings.
That's a very good question. Yeah, I mean, I think the question really is, how do we affect the change that we need to be seeing? And does it involve simply changing the way people are thinking at the top? But I think there's a number of things that are worth thinking about, which is that just in recent days, actually, just in the wake of the recent publication of the last assessment report of the UN climate panel, the IPCC, mm-hmm. we've actually seen some quite heartening evidence that people at that level are actually taking it seriously and at a human level are actually thinking about, well, wait a minute, that we need to do something about this. And there's an interesting contrast here between the way in which corporations have responded. So on the day of the publication of the IPCC assessment report of climate impacts, Exxon published its own kind of world energy outlook and various other reports, basically saying that, we don't think that there's any chance that governments are going to dramatically reduce their emissions, and they basically said that there's no real chance of a low carbon scenario emerging this century, and that we intend to continue to continue burning all the rest of the fossil fuels that we have available in our reserves. So that was you know, a clear statement of defiance.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously also a statement to its investors that, okay, we have this very worrying climate report, but don't worry, you can continue investing with us because fossil fuels are here to stay. Just about 2 weeks after that, a coalition of some of the largest transnational companies in the world, including Unilever, including Royal Dutch Shell, which is a major oil and gas company, and many other companies. And I think these are mostly British and European companies, but I might be wrong. But this coalition of I think it was about certainly over a dozen of these very big companies. They released a communique, and this was actually reported in The Guardian, which they all signed, saying that we basically recognize that what the IPCC is telling us is very, very serious. We recognize that we must seek to end our fossil fuel dependency by the end of the century, as the IPCC is recommending. And we intend to basically change our policies to kind of accelerate this drive. And that means that we recognize that there is a need to basically ensure that the trillions of dollars worth of carbon that could be burnt doesn't get burnt and stays under the ground. Now, that obviously is something that is a very, very big thing for these kinds of companies to say. Now, whether this was, you know, some might argue that cynically that this is a PR move or whatever, you know, even if it is a cynical PR move, the reality is that it's being stated publicly and they can now be held to that. And that's something which is unprecedented. It's not been said before. And it also shows that these companies are recognizing that it's not just climate itself which is changing. It's the climate of human politics and human culture is also changing, and that people are now saying, recognizing that we need to move away from fossil fuels, and these companies are trying to get in line with that trajectory. So whichever way you look at it, there is this trajectory taking place. There are people at that level who clearly, whatever their corporate structures are telling them and their business as usual models are telling them, people as human beings, I think, are recognizing that, well, you know, I want to have a planet for my grandchildren to inherit. And as a human being, I need to basically act in the interests of my fellow human beings. Mm-hmm. And that's an inspiring thing, and it's something that suggests that while these entrenched corporate entities and their structures and their dynamics of, you know, kind of very narrow profiteering are very damaging and are very powerful, the fact is that they're still run by people, and that many of those people are good people, and that they can be changed and they can be influenced. So it isn't a battle that is automatically lost. Having said that, I think, you know, we have seen a lot of inertia at the political level. We've seen a lot of inertia at the corporate level. And it continues, you know. And so even though this is an isolated, you know, we have to remember this is an isolated case. This is not all the companies of the world or all of the major fossil corporations. This is still a handful. There's a huge amount of work to be done. So for me, I think, you know, the real action is not really just a case of how we change corporations, how we influence corporations. We have to look much deeper at the kind of root systemic causes of this. And that really is not just about changing corporate behavior, but it's about looking at the system which incubates corporations and which requires corporations to exist. And that means looking at the whole nature of capitalism and the whole nature of this very, very unequal ownership of resources that we currently have, where a tiny minority of the world's population, represented by this conglomerate of interlocking banking networks, corporate networks, and so on, own and control the vast majority of the world's resources, from water to fossil fuels to raw materials to their technologies and information technologies, which allow us to kind of distribute these and so on and so forth. All of that is owned and controlled by a tiny minority, and the rest of us do not have access to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very unnatural condition, which didn't kind of come by accident. It happened through a process of colonization and eventually globalization.
Yeah. We need to pause for a moment. That will bring us to an interesting email along those lines. Is there a way, I don't know how you change the capitalist system that many countries embrace right now, but does that need to happen? We'll have an email response to that in just one moment. And I also want to, for Nafees to give us his vision of what a post-carbon world at its best would look like if civilization starts thriving in a whole other way. What are we looking at? We'll welcome a few more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our email is talk@wpr.org. Nafees Ahmed is executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in England. He's an international security analyst, author of A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nafees, this email came in along the same lines of what you were talking about. Paul says, one shudders at the thought of massacres, endless wars, and other brutal persecutions during the medieval plague, often ascribed to supernatural forces. What role does promoting and sustaining democratic governments that also promote equality and ultimately empathy and compassion, what role does that play in our whole discussion?
Well, I think that's absolutely critical. You know, I mean, I think what's very important in looking ahead is really a focusing on the kind of what are the values of the system that we would like to see. And I think that's where this idea of an empathic civilization is so important. I mean, this idea was put out by a guy. He's actually referred to this idea of empathic civilization, this guy Jeremy Rifkin, who has advised the European Union. He talks about the possibility of a third industrial revolution based on kind of renewable energies and smart grid technology and information technology. It's very, very interesting stuff. But one of the things he also talks about is this idea that this kind of change that we hope to see technologically needs to accompany a shift in values where, you know, people start to recognize that actually this kind of crude, kind of almost materialist, reductionist self-interest is not actually in our real self-interest, is actually quite destructive. And that we need to kind of recognize that moral values, ethical values, values of compassion, values of thinking about the other are actually quite important values that are very important for the prosperity of our societies and obviously of all the people in them. And this makes for quite an interesting analysis. And in my view, what I have actually, in my book, I talk about this a little bit more about what the implications of all of this are in terms of values. Because if you look at the values of the current system and where it's going, if you look at the kind of the values responsible for the crisis of civilization that we see, the issues of climate change, of energy depletion, you know, the issues of global conflict that are linked to resource depletion and things like that, those values are clearly values that most of us would abhor. And those values are, you know, things like kind of selfishness, things like, you know, kind of material overaccumulation, and so on and so forth. And, you know, with the evidence that we've got from the scientific community, it's now clear that that form of behavior, these values are actually leading to potentially the extinction of not just many, many species on the planet, but potentially the extinction of the human species as well, if you look at the worst-case scenarios. So that gives us an indication that actually these values don't really work. They're not actually they're actually objectively that great. So even though on a short-term individual level, if you look, you think, okay, that's really great, that's going to work for me, they don't actually work for the survival of the species in the long run. And that's very interesting because it suggests that these other values, like compassion and generosity and love, actually are much more in tune with the way the world works and our relationship with our environment. And that's interesting because it actually suggests that these values actually have a kind of an evolutionary function. In fact, that maybe being more generous, being thinking about other people, thinking about your neighbor, or not just your neighbor, but and not just your countryman, but also your fellow human citizen who is in another country. And actually, that's actually a very important important basis for the survival of the species. I think that's very interesting, and it does suggest that those systems of any systems of politics or economics or other social systems which are able to embody those values are more likely to succeed than systems which don't in the long run.
Yeah. Let's go to Ron in Kimberley. We have a couple minutes left in the show. Hi, Ron. Are you there, Ron? Ron's not there. So if you were going to give me about a minute and a half, if you were going to envision a world where we didn't collapse, but we created something different, what would your non-carbon world look like?
Well, I think it's important to remember that if you look at the trajectory of where we're going now, on a business as usual scale, and you kind of go forward to the end of the century, there is no possibility that this current form of civilization will survive. It doesn't matter whichever way you look at it. We're not going to be able to rely on fossil fuels by the end of the century. It's just not going to happen. And that's based on all the conventional readings. So whatever way you look at it, it's not going to work. We need something to shift, and it is going to shift, and we're already seeing that happening now. Something is going to have to change, and either it will change willingly or it will change unwillingly. And obviously the unwilling scenario is the one we don't want to go down. So I think within this situation, we have an unprecedented opportunity. So what the crisis is unprecedented, there is an unprecedented opportunity to kind of seize this moment of crisis and transition to something much more exciting and much more interesting. And the possibilities of that do exist. I kind of envisage a post-carbon world, and I very much think this is something which is not, shouldn't be kind of top-down generated, and it shouldn't just be one person's ideas. Everyone has to be in it together. We all have to be part of this process of creating, co-creating what comes, rather than having one entity or one structure telling us what it should be. And that's integral to the nature of this post-carbon world. I think it needs to be much more participatory, much more about people taking charge and saying how they think things need to be working together. In terms of how that will play out in terms of technology, definitely a clean energy infrastructure is essential. And that looks like one based on renewable energies like solar, wind, geothermal, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We're already at a transition point where those forms of energy are now increasingly cost competitive with fossil fuels. So we're right this year on the tipping point of that energy revolution. That energy revolution ties with the political and economic revolution where people become owners of capital, owners of energy, owners of, for example, even food and food production. And I think that would obviously change the landscape of politics, because the more people who actually are owning and controlling energy themselves and producing it themselves, the more power they have economically.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you, Nafiz Ahmed, our guest this hour. His book is A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization. The piece that he wrote that was in The Guardian is on our Facebook page if you would like to read it. Some big questions we were taking on. Is the world as we know it about to come to an end? And we simply have to create something different. He is an investigative journalist and executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News coming up, we'll return.